AM and 90.9 FM HD3, Urbana.
This is Keeping the Faith, a weekly discussion about issues of faith, spirituality, religion, and ethics. Now here's your host, Steve Shoemaker.
Our guest today on Keeping the Faith is Richard G. Watts. Dick Watts is the author of Hungers of the Heart, a new book about spirituality and religion for the 21st century. Welcome, Dick.
Thank you, Steve.
Thank you for coming over from Bloomington, Illinois for this program. Dick, I'd like our listeners to get a taste of what your book sounds like, what some of the ideas in it are. Would you mind reading just a section on duty? This is in your chapter on our hunger to be real persons, chapter 2. But I thought that this little segment might give people a sense of what you're thinking about here.
Well, I'd be glad to do that. This is part of a section which I call Dusting Off an Antique Word, and that antique word is duty.
Yes.
And this is the paragraph you're referring to. Whatever our faults and mistakes, we need to identify what is good and trustworthy in us, celebrate it, and stay true to it. As George Bernard Shaw has a character in one of his plays say, this is the true joy in life, being a force of nature instead of a feverish, selfish little clot of ailments and grievances, complaining that the world will not devote itself to making you happy. For personal happiness is not so much a direct attainment as it is the byproduct of responsible living.
And that last sentence is yours after the quote from George Bernard Shaw. It's sort of yours. Now, that we should say quickly that this book is not only honoring the life and thought of another man, Carl, is it Eisenwein?
Essenwein.
Essenwein.
Yes.
Carl Essenwein, who died in 06, a friend of yours, a Unitarian Universalist pastor. This book honors him, but he also gave to you his writings.
He did, yes.
And you mentioned in this book quite early that this book is based on his writings.
It's a really an unusual collaboration. Carl died 4 years ago. He was a friend whom I learned to know late in his life, for much of which time he was fighting a battle with cancer. He was a businessman who earlier, for a couple of decades, had been, as you suggested, a Unitarian minister. Well, we used to meet over breakfast, and over at IHOP, he would always bring his own coffee because IHOP's was too weak. And we would solve all the world's problems, talk about theology, the state of the church, and so on, and found that we very much saw the world, saw the faith eye to eye. And when the doctors had done all that they were able to do and the end was near, I said to Carl, did you keep all your writings, all your sermons? And he had done that. So I said, how about bequeathing them to me? And I'll see if I can't get the benefit of your thinking out to a wider group of people. He did that. I had a great long, probably 6 or 8 feet file full of his writings, and I spent several years mulling over them, organizing them, and then intersecting my own thinking with Carl's. And we have a book here that really, as I read over it, it's hard to tell where Carl ends and I begin. I think we very much saw the world in a similar way.
Now, the last chapter, you say, is pretty much all you, although of course, his thought has influenced you, as you say.
That's the one on our relationship with other religions, which
yeah.
has been a very hot issue in the last couple of decades, right?
Sure. And you have a previous book that you also wrote with someone else. Tell us about that.
Well, that was a book I wrote with John Dominic Crossan, who was a scholar in the search for the historical Jesus. And that also had an interesting story. I was actually leading a group of mostly university people discussing his book called Jesus, a Revolutionary Biography. And at one point, they got they got very bogged down in the terminology. And my wife Charlene and I were having coffee one day, and I said, you know, I'd really like to take that guy's book and translate it into plain English for people who've never had a theological education.
Sure.
And she has a habit of doing things like this, so she said, well, why don't you do it? So I actually wrote a letter to Crossan and said, I don't mean to offend, but I really would like to work on this book with you. And to my great surprise, he called me up a couple weeks later and said, that's a great idea. Let's do it.
Wow.
And so for a year, I would take a chapter of his work, his research at a time, do my, quote, translating into everyday English, and then we'd talk it over. And actually, we produced the book.
When did that come out, Dick?
Oh, that was about 1996. And we produced the book, Who is Jesus? Answers to Your Questions About the Historical Jesus, before actually we had ever met one another in person. Did it all over the phone for a year. Great adventure.
And that was before the wide use of the internet.
It was.
Harder to do by phone.
Harder to do by phone, but a great education for me.
We're talking with Dick Watts about his new book, Hungers of the Heart, Spirituality and Religion for the 21st Century, which can be purchased a number of places, but probably most easily online at booklocker.com. Booklocker is all one word, booklocker.com. This is out just in 2010, and it's gotten quite a lot of conversation started about the issues that are in this book. Let's continue having some here. And I'll invite listeners to join in if they'd like. The phone numbers, you're listening in Champaign-Urbana, if it's a local call, punch in 333-9455. If it's long distance, perhaps you're listening on the internet at will.illinois.edu/am. If it's a long distance call, punch in 1-800-222-9455. So locally, 333-WILL, long distance 1-800-222-WILL. Dick, in this book, you begin by talking about our hungers to be at home in the cosmos. What were you trying to do in that first chapter?
Well, you know, one of the things that's happening, I think, religiously in our country, and this is particularly true in the younger generation, is we have increasing numbers of people who say, I consider myself spiritual but not religious. And what I take that to mean is that they have certain longings to know how they fit in the universe, what they can believe and what they can count on. But they don't find the language of the church particularly compelling, and particularly the traditional God language. So what I mean by that question is, how do we look at our place in the overall scheme of things in the big picture, particularly when some of the traditional words for talking about that big picture, God, salvation, redemption, etc., are less meaningful for many people than they used to be.
And although you yourself come from the Christian tradition, you really write this book for people who are struggling with these kind of issues from many different perspectives and traditions.
I do, and I'm also convinced that many people who are firmly within the Christian tradition, who are sitting in the pews week after week, nonetheless also have these questions. That is, the skeptical, critical questions are within each of us and not only in those who are outside the institutions.
So it's also for people who are, your book is also for people who are turned off by organized religion.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And what about people who are questioning where they grew up and where they came from and what their parents may have taught them or their home congregations?
Well, you know, my view is that if you're not questioning what you were brought up with and what was kind of the environment in which you grew, you're not growing. You're not aware. Even if we end up roughly at a place where our parents were or our original church was, if we don't get there via our own questioning, our own skepticism, and our own struggle, it'll never be authentic. And so one of the things that I want to say to people is never fear your questions. Never fear skeptical inquiry. It's the way to your personal wisdom.
Now, what about pietism? People who just feel good about what they believe, it's meeting their emotional needs, and they really just don't want to think about the hard questions and the hard issues and to be skeptical.
Well, I suppose one ought to say, if it works for you, okay. And yet, it seems to me that in my experience, most people have a certain time in their life when maybe an experience, maybe it's an illness, maybe it's a tragedy, maybe it's something happening globally, causes them to question the simplicities that perhaps they believed as children. And all of a sudden it seems to them that, well, maybe God isn't in his heaven and all's right with the world, so I've got to think. Perhaps, as you suggest, there are some people who go through their life placidly, simply accepting what they were born into. But I doubt that that's true of very many of us. I think, particularly in this modern world where we're kind of living between the times, pretty much everybody is rethinking things, and sometimes from scratch.
I'm thinking of the current movie, the title of which combines the words ridiculous and religious.
Right, right. Religulous.
Yes, that kind of skepticism. And you quote in your book, I loved your openness to this, you talk about people who sing quite innocently the old hymn, "All things bright and beautiful, all creatures great and small, all things wise and wonderful, the Lord God made them all." But then you go on to quote the Monty Python version that goes, "All things dull and ugly, all creatures short and squat, all things rude and nasty, the Lord God made the lot."
Exactly. Exactly.
How do you bring those two together?
I certainly don't have answers for what is obviously the perennial question that all great religious movements have had to deal with, namely, in a world that you trust is meaningful and in some deep sense good, how do you account for evil? How do you account for suffering? What about the tsunamis that wipe people out unfeelingly? I'm always skeptical of anyone in any tradition who has an easy answer for that. One of the approaches to the question that makes most sense to me is don't try to analyze suffering. Do what you can to heal it. Be part of mending what is broken, but don't try to find silver theological linings on other people's black clouds.
We're talking with Dick Watts, the author of the recently published book, Hungers of the Heart. We encourage listeners to give us a call if you'd like, 333-9455 or long distance 1-800-222-9455. Dick, you have made this book very useful to not only individuals but to groups, and you have a sort of a study guide in the back, which I appreciated being there. You also have footnotes that are helpful and also suggestions on where people can go who want to follow up on some of these issues. But it's not like a typical bibliography. I like the fact that you've annotated these things and suggested how these particular books could be helpful for people who have a question about the problem of evil or a lot of the other things in many of your chapters.
Well, I appreciate that, and especially that you sense the aim to make this very accessible. I tried very hard for this to be a reader-friendly kind of a book. Oftentimes people have said to me, you know, I wish you had said more about this or more about that. And my answer always is that it was very deliberate, that I didn't want to pretend to be the answer man who knows it all. What I want to do is start a conversation. And the reason for the suggestions for discussion is my picture of a healthy religious movement is that four, five, six people sit around somebody's kitchen with a cup of coffee and talk about these things with each other without having to have a religious professional there to tell them what they ought to think. And if this book can be used that way by, quote, ordinary, unquote, persons out of talking about their own experience, talking about their own skepticism, talking about their own deep convictions and intuitions, then I will have achieved what I set out to do.
Early on in this book, you deal with an issue that's particularly with modern people who are aware of science and the theories of evolution. You deal with that whole sort of issue, but I loved your footnote early on where you say, in contrast to fundamentalist attacks on evolutionary biology, progressive Christians are actually celebrating Darwin's birthday each year as a way of affirming the compatibility of science and religion. And you mentioned that some 13,000 clergy have signed a letter to that effect. And for example, last February, there were over 800 congregations of Jews and Christians in all 50 states and 13 countries celebrating Evolution Weekend.
Right, right.
We've had Dean Zimmerman from Indiana on the program talking about how he got that started, and that's the clergy letter and the Evolutionary Weekend celebration.
It's a great project, and the church where my wife and I worship is one that celebrates Darwin's birthday every year, Evolution Sunday. And, you know, I think we need to bring this front and center, because if you pay attention only to the mass media, you would think that Christian churches around the country are in full-scale rebellion against the idea of evolution, with all of the right-wing efforts to change the science curriculum in the public schools and so forth. And it simply is not true. I went, for example, to a Presbyterian college, the College of Worcester in Ohio, where 100 years ago, the president of that college debated William Jennings Bryan on the subject of evolution, pointing out its compatibility with the Christian faith. So this is nothing new, but we're in a time when there's been a rightward swing to attempt to turn the clock back to the days before we had this kind of biological knowledge about our evolutionary heritage. And I think people really need to know, no, that isn't where the Christian church as a whole is, and Evolution Sunday is one way to demonstrate that.
You mentioned the congregation that you and Charlene attend in Bloomington. That's the New Covenant Community Church?
It is.
Tell us about that.
Well, it's a very interesting ecumenical church that is related to the Presbyterian Church, to the United Church of Christ, and to the Disciples of Christ, because it grows out of cooperative work and campus ministry at ISU. It's interesting in that the people who are part of that congregation come from all over the place in terms of their background. I looked out one day when I was the pastor there before I retired, and I saw people whose background were Roman Catholic and Christian Science and Unitarian and Apostolic Christian and et cetera, all over. And in a sense, we advertised for such people. When we were forming, we put an ad in the paper that said, "Are you a church dropout?" And we did that because we thought that people drop out of churches sometimes for very good reasons. They're bored stiff. They're put off by what a friend of mine called Neanderthal theology. They're never given a chance to express their own points of view, their own questions. So it's been an exciting mix of people, many of whom I think were saying to themselves, well, I'll give it one last try, because I think there's something in this church business after all. So let's try this one. One of the things that happens in our church for example, is that after the pastors, we have a clergy couple as pastors, after they present a reflection briefly, we take the microphone and pass it around the congregation for anyone who has their own experience or insight to bear on the morning topic. And though we have talented pastors who are worth listening to, many times one goes home thinking also about the comments made by fellow worshipers. I've always thought, Steve, that it really doesn't make much sense to have people sit in church listening week after week after week to the Christian message from one person with the same experience, the same brain, the same personality, as though all of those people sitting there had nothing to contribute to the conversation. I think we really need to break through that monopoly of the clergy and develop a church where people talk to each other about their shared experience.
And let's be sure we let listeners know that you can do that right now. This is a live program, a live call-in program every Sunday night here on WILL AM 580 and FM 90.9 HD3 Urbana and online. And so if you would like to join this conversation, we're eager to have your questions or comments with our guest, Dick Watts, Richard G. Watts, author of the new book, Hungers of the Heart: Spirituality and Religion for the 21st Century. Do give us a call, 333-9455, and our good engineer, Kyle Crow, will answer the call and put you in line to be on the air. You will need to turn your radio down when you're on the phone because we do have a slight delay between the program and what you're hearing. If it's a long-distance call, 1-800-222-9455, anywhere in the continental U.S., you may give us a call. So locally, 333-9455. Dick, tell us about two pocket people. You begin by quoting Martin Buber on page 43, the Jewish thinker and writer, and he told this story of Hasidic master who said that we human beings should always have two pockets to reach into according to our need. In the right pocket should be the words, "For my sake, the world was created." In the left pocket, "I am dust and ashes." And you comment after that, "Perhaps spiritual wisdom begins with accepting both of these truths about ourselves."
I do, because I think we have a tendency to view ourselves either as simply a part of nature subject to all the vicissitudes of life in the world, or we see ourselves as spiritual beings who do not have to pay attention to bodily needs or to the frailties of human life. And I think wisdom consists in recognizing that on the one hand, we are indeed frail and vulnerable creatures, and there is no God of special favors who is going to save us from the ills to which all flesh is heir. And on the other hand, we are people who have a certain dignity by virtue of our humanity, that we need to recognize the creativity and the art and the music and the compassion and the love that go into making us also who we are. Both things are part of who we are. Life for us is both very fragile and very resilient and beautiful.
Does dust and ashes go far enough, though, to describe the kind of nastiness that humans can do to one another?
Well, if you're asking about what is the source of evil in human beings,
I don't care so much about the source, but I just want to make sure we take seriously how bad it can be.
Yeah, yeah.
And I'm not sure that all Unitarians do.
All Unitarians?
Well, you know, you're doing this book with this Unitarian pastor, and if I'm sort of picking out where you and he are agreeing and disagreeing, I think you agree on the capacity of human beings to be good and to do something, and you encourage people to be courageous and do things.
And also in the possibility of human beings to be selfish, bitter, narrow, pedestrian,
okay,
and hurtful. Yes. One of the parts of the book that we haven't talked about yet deals with the crisis that our country has recently gone through, for example, the financial meltdown, where it's not simply that some things over which we had no control went very badly, but people made selfish, greedy decisions that caused the rest of us a great deal of harm. I wouldn't want to live in a world where there are no police, as I don't think you would. And there is something very robust, I think, about traditional Christian theology in recognizing that there is a selfishness and aggressiveness also at the core of people that has to be decided against and controlled where it is inflicted upon the innocent and the weak.
In the part of your book you're referring to about the current financial meltdown, you have a wonderful section where you quote what Greenspan said in Congress at how shocked he was.
Shocked,
that the institutions on which he had put his faith had really come apart because of things like you just mentioned, greed and pride.
And I think that's a place where, you know, Christians are sometimes accused of being naive, but I think where the traditional faith is far more realistic than the kind of naivete that led a Greenspan into an untrammeled trust in the wisdom of Wall Street financiers to do what was right for the common good. I think we've always known... I'm not sure that I want to call it original sin. I'm not sure that's one of the most helpful characteristics, but I do want to talk about an innate selfishness that is at war with our quest for the common good and requires us to make better choices than we've been making.
We're getting close to halfway through our program today. We're talking with Richard G. Watts from Bloomington, Illinois, about his new 2010 book, Dealing with Spirituality and Religion for the 21st Century, Hungers of the Heart, which can be found most easily at booklocker.com online. Hungers of the Heart by Richard G. Watts, W-A-T-T-S. Dick, tell us a little bit about your personal story. How did you get to the place where you are now writing these books and... talking on the radio about them? Where have you been before this? You mentioned having gone to College of Worcester. Where did you grow up?
I grew up in Rochester, New York. I was an inner city kid, although I didn't know that until I got to seminary and heard the term. I thought everybody played their baseball out in the streets. So that's where I started out.
And where did you go after college?
After college, I went to McCormick Seminary in Chicago. And then from seminary straight down here to Champaign-Urbana, where I worked at the McKinley Foundation, with which you have some small acquaintance, I understand.
I've heard of it.
That was my first job, and then went from there over to the First Presbyterian Church in Normal because I was eager to work with university students and personnel in an ordinary, regular parish church. Spent about 11 years there. Went to a large metropolitan church outside Cleveland after that. And then I became very concerned about the state of the world and the international arms race. At that time, the great talk about a limited nuclear war between the U.S. and the Soviet Union. And I resigned a pastorate and spent about 10 years working on a peacemaking project dealing with global militarism and trying to organize people to be to say no to that and to the occasional wars that cropped up, such as in Central America. So it's, I guess you'd call that a checkered history, wouldn't you?
Varied, at least. We have a caller late waiting on line number one. Yes, you're on the air with our guest today on Keeping the Faith, Dick Watts. Line number one from Champaign, Illinois.
Yeah, hello there.
Hello.
What's the chance that Thomas Jefferson's revisions of Scripture, which I believe are passed out to every new congressman, kind of put a distance between perhaps an imaginary Christian country and what we have as a government now?
Well, I'm very interested in Thomas Jefferson's efforts. As you know, what he did was he basically took a pair of scissors and went to work on the Gospels, removing all that he thought was mythological encrustation and leaving what he felt was the pure ethical teaching of Jesus. I have a certain amount of empathy with that, although I tend to look at the symbolic nature of the Gospels in a way that Jefferson did not. But if you look, for example, compare the Sermon on the Mount. The Sermon on the Mount is entirely about ethical behavior, how not to be a hypocrite, how to treat others as you would have them treat you, do your praying in private instead of showing your piety before people. It's all about behavior and ethics. Then go from that to one of the creeds, like the Apostles' Creed, which is all about belief and nothing about behaving. So I think Jefferson was on to something, that there is in Jesus a particular imperative about what it means to love God and neighbor by your behaving, and isn't a matter so much of, it's not a matter at all of dogmatic belief. Now, how all this plays out in our country is a whole nother question. We have in many places the idea that the founders intended this to be a Christian country, and yet, on the other hand, one of the first foreign treaties that the country made, begun in the time of George Washington and then sent through the Senate during the Adams administration, in a treaty with Tripoli, said the United States is not in any sense a Christian nation, from which I take it that the founders wanted a Christian ethic to guide the people because they believed that morality was the foundation of good government, but they did not want any quarter given to the dogmatic claims of a particular religion, including Christianity.
We're a little bit past halfway in our program. Let me let listeners know, and I do thank that caller for that question. Let me let listeners know who's coming up in future programs. Next week we have a Christian Science practitioner, Elise Moore, who will be speaking with us by phone from her home in Nashville, Tennessee. On January 16th, on the Martin Luther King weekend, we'll be replaying one of our programs from this last fall, an interview with C.D. Wright. Carolyn Wright is an award-winning, internationally known poet. Her new book was One with Others. There's an article about that book in the current New Yorker, for example. It's received quite a lot of critical review. And she talks about the civil rights movement in Arkansas, and in a sort of narrative, a sort of story, a sort of novel, a sort of poem called One with Others. So that will be replayed in archive program on January 16 at 5 o'clock. I remind listeners also that if you're in the Champaign-Urbana area, the annual Martin Luther King celebration at the university, where scholarships are given for local students to go on to college by the Martin Luther King Advocacy for Justice Committee. That will be in the Krannert Great Hall also at 5 o'clock on Sunday, January 16. On January 23rd, here on Keeping the Faith, Abby Harmon will be our guest. She is a graduate student here at the University of Illinois, and she's been working with the homeless for the last couple of years, and has become quite well known in the community because of her advocacy, very effective advocacy for those who are homeless in Champaign-Urbana. Those are some of the programs coming up here on Keeping the Faith. I'm Steve Shoemaker, the usual host. Although the interview we just had last week was done by Don Nolan, a professor of philosophy and religion at Parkland College, who helps out on this program regularly. Thank him for that help. Well, let's get back to talking with Dick Watts, our guest today, about Hungers of the Heart, his newest book. Dick, I was intrigued by the statistics you have. This book does not have many statistics, but the ones you selected, and whether they come originally from Carl Essenwine or you, I don't know that. But these statistics about you're suggesting in one section the importance of meditation and finding some time to be alone with yourself. But you point out how difficult it is to be alone now that we have in the U.S. gone from 2.7 hours a week spent online in the last 10 years to now up to 18 hours a week online. And we've gone from 12 billion daily emails in 10 years up to 247 billion
yes.
daily emails. That's scary.
And one of the things that I'm saying in the book is that all of these methods of electronic communication may be wonderful in bringing people closer together, or they may be a way of hiding from ourselves, not being willing to take the time to, as someone said, sit alone with your soul and poke it and see which way it moves. And that is a concern. It's also a concern for our interpersonal relationships. I don't know if you've seen this, Steve, but I have, and I find it very painful to sit in a restaurant and see a young couple sitting in a booth, and one of them is sitting quietly, ignored, while the other is busy on the cell phone, or what to me is even worse, a child sitting there and mother or father is totally preoccupied with what's going on in the cell phone or other electronic form of communication. And I am concerned about that as to what happens to our need for solitude, to sense where we are in the living of our days, and what happens to our relationships when we're not dealing face-to-face but only electronically, and then sometimes using the electronics to keep the other out. That concerns me.
You talk in your book, Hungers of the Heart, about the importance of being alone and finding out who you are and then being in a relationship with others, as you've just been saying, being present with others, sharing with others, sharing honestly, truthfully with others. And then you talk about, let me read this so I get it exactly, to be grateful is at the heart of a spiritual life. To be grateful. What is there about gratitude that seems to cross religious boundaries?
Somebody has said that, you know, if I did not believe in God, what I would miss most would be someone to say thank you to. It seems to me that one can go even further to say that whether one has a God figure or not in his or her life, each of us has that innate need to say, wow, look at what I'm surrounded by. I get a free ride around the sun once every year. I've got these people who care about me. I've got some work that I can do that seems to be useful. Wow. And it seems to me, and I try to say this in the book, that experience of wow, something marvelous is going on here, is at the root of both science and religion. Carl Sagan, for example, who is one of my intellectual heroes, talks about reverential astonishment as something that is a widely known experience of scientists. Well, to me, reverential astonishment comes very close to what you're talking about when you say a spirit of thankfulness. I think that's really central to our humanity.
One of the difficulties with the way traditional Christianity has been understood, you point out in the book, is the focus on the afterlife. Would you talk with us a little bit about that?
I think that's a focus that is weakening but is not getting sufficient attention or honest discussion. Many people say, I don't want to think about that. I'm content to leave that to God. Well, if one is really content to leave the question of an afterlife to God, I have no trouble with that. But sometimes I think it's a bit of a cop-out for people who maybe are unwilling to say, gosh, I'm not sure that that idea really makes sense to me. I look around me and the way I see life and experience it is all things, all creatures, including us, come into being. They grow, they flourish, they decline, they die, and another generation takes over. I think we need to talk to each other about this kind of question and not simply assume that it's a central part of the faith we've inherited.
You say that one of the major themes of Orthodox Christian faith is in the words of St. Paul, if for this life only we have hoped in Christ, we are of all people most to be pitied. If the dead are not raised, let us eat, drink, for tomorrow we die. Then you go on to say, does that argument make sense to you?
It makes no sense to me. Uh-huh. It makes no sense to me that if this is the one life that I have, shall I be ungrateful for it? And if this is the one life that I have, shall I go out and behave contrary to every inclination of what makes for a meaningful life? No. So I think St. Paul got a lot of things right, and I think he got that dead wrong.
Is that true, though, only, Dick, for people who are healthy and, you know, who have enough money to survive and, you know, who have their mental capacities, or does it take some kind of a concept of the afterlife for there to be any fairness for people who just live a life of agony?
Well, it's an incredibly tough question. I remember one time in my life when I most deeply felt the power of that question myself. It was during the civil rights days in the 1960s, and I was in Mississippi. And there was a little old African-American woman who had been a servant to the governor of the state and whose life had been full of difficulties and trials. And I remember thinking to myself clearly, there has got to be something else for people like this. She deserves it. I think that's an almost innate feeling we have that where justice is not served here, we desperately want it to be served somewhere.
Sometime.
Nonetheless, I think the alternative to positing an afterlife in which things are set straight is to double our determination that so long as we have the breath of life, we're going to do what we can to set things straight, to comfort the sick, to heal, to do justice. It's a little bit, I think, of a cop-out to expect God in another life to do what we fail to do in this one, to make life habitable for everyone.
We're down to close to our last 11 or 12 minutes. Let me give the phone numbers again for listeners who'd like to join this conversation and ask a question or comment of our guest, Dick Watts, 333-9455. If it's in the 217 area code, if it's long distance, 1-800-222-9455 is a toll-free call you can make. And if you've missed part of this program or have to leave early and would like to hear the rest of it, do know that it will be archived within a day or two here at WILL. You can find this program by punching in your computer www.will.illinois.edu/keepingthefaith. And you can leave the G out of keeping, and that'll get you to it very quickly. If you forget all that, just go to search for WILL, and you'll find a way to get to AM and then Keeping the Faith archives. Dick, we're talking about spirituality and religion in general. You come, as we've mentioned, from a Christian background and are yourself a Protestant Christian pastor. But you have some suggestions in your book for what people might look for if they're looking for a religious community, On page 85, you have a wonderful list of what people might want to keep in mind as they're looking at some potential communities. You say no one's perfect, no institution is perfect, but you think some are better than others. Tell us what things people should look for.
Well, maybe I should just run down this list. I'm suggesting that people who are open to being part of an organized religious community, it doesn't matter whether it's Christian, Jewish, Muslim, Buddhist, or what have you, I suggest looking for a community that has these characteristics, that it not only tolerates but encourages doubt and skepticism of inherited tradition, that it relates ancient wisdom, its scriptures, to contemporary issues, thus giving worship the odor of reality, that it embraces, doesn't just tolerate, diversity, whether that's racial, economic, sexual, political, that it provides face-to-face groups where people can learn to care for each other, that it harvests everyone's insights instead of passively accepting the words of the preacher or priest or imam, that cultivates a sense of humor, never confusing the inherited metaphors of the sacred for the sacred itself, and that trusts a community that trusts it's better to believe too little than too much, and that it's good to rest content with questions that are unanswered, and that provides a vision of the human future that is at odds with what currently passes for reality. That is, there is some picture of a better world that we can be working for to redeem our lives from insignificance.
And when people find that kind of a community that has some or most of those characteristics, what do you see will be the result? Why is it important to be part of a community at all?
Because we are all hungry for relationships, and it gets very tiring for us to bear our burdens and to carry our questions all by ourselves. When we can have a community in which we feel safe, in which it's okay to say what you really think, in which we have, as St. Paul said, we rejoice with those who rejoice and weep with those who weep, that's just a powerful antidote to loneliness, to depression. I think all of us need that kind of community. And for all its faults, the church is the most widespread community of that sort in our society and deserves a better rap than it's getting.
In the last section of the book, which you deal with some very current issues, you talk about the problems of nationalism, of us being so committed to our nation that we tend not to look beyond its borders or its own interests. Why is that a problem?
Well, our biggest issue, I think, is that our technologies have far outpaced our moral development, and that puts us on the edge of disaster, whether it's nuclear disaster or ecological disaster. We've got something like 180 separate sovereignties in the world, and yet all of our problems cross all these borders. I mean, there's no such thing as a Jewish ozone problem, and there's no such thing as a Protestant deforestation problem or a pollution problem. All of these things belong to all of us, these problems, and they don't respect national boundaries. I mention in the book one of the a story that's very meaningful to me about actually a Saudi Arabian astronaut who talked about being up there in space and looking out the window towards Earth. And here's what he said. He said, you know, the first day we all point to our countries. By the third day we point to our continents. By the fifth day, all we're aware of is that there's one world. And this is the reality, I think the spiritual reality. I think the great spiritual sign of our time and symbol is that picture of Earth from space, recognizing that we're the first generation ever to see the Earth whole and entire. And we will either accept that spiritual symbol as our own, or the prospects for the future of our species remain dim.
My daughter teaches first grade in a Chicago school, and it's the school that has a number of students from refugee families, from some from Muslim countries, some from Christian countries, some from, well, all around. I think out of 27 kids, 18 of them, their first language is not English. And they're so new to this country, she found it difficult to just teach them the Pledge of Allegiance to the flag of this country.
Yes.
And so she came up with this pledge. We pledge allegiance to the earth and all the people on it, and to the resources that we all need, one creation in our hands to cherish and serve with freedom and peace for all. That kind of, I thought, fit with some of your concerns in that last chapter of your book.
I think it's very beautiful, and I think also we need to be quite clear that we can say the pledge to our flag with the spirit that accepts the pledge that you have just read and dedicate our country not simply to its own well-being but to its role in assuring the well-being of all peoples. As I mention in the book, Golda Meir one time had a marvelous line. She said, "Globalism does not mean the end of individual nations any more than an orchestra means the end of violins." So we need to play our part in the global melody, but always remember that it is a global melody.
We're talking with Dick Watts, Richard G. Watts, W-A-T-T-S, about his book Hungers of the Heart, out just this year. I guess last year, isn't it? It was 2010. Here we are in 2011. Spirituality and Religion for the 21st Century, available online at booklocker.com.
Yeah, I was interested to notice I went to Amazon.com and found it was there, but it was a humbling experience because the first book titled Hunger of the Heart was a vampire novel.
Yes, titles cannot be copyrighted.
That's so, right. So look for the second title, not the first one.
Yeah, titles cannot be copyrighted, so there can be several. This is Hungers of the Heart by Richard G. Watts. Dick, you mentioned the Fellowship of Reconciliation in this book, and one of the people from that organization that has been working trying to cross international boundaries on behalf of peace, and we have had the U.S. president of FOR here on this program before. And you say that there's not much attention given to these kind of organizations that are working for world understanding and peace,
right,
and understanding across different religious lines.
Right, and a great deal is happening. We're all aware of the role of religion in either blessing or exacerbating violence. It's painfully obvious to us, but the media have paid very little attention to the role of religious bodies in making peace. And one of the stories that I tell in the book is about the case in East Germany, where actually the fall of the wall, the events leading up to that, came out of church groups gathering together, moving out into the city of Leipzig, having been taught the methods of nonviolence from Gandhi and King and Bonhoeffer. And after the success of that effort and the fall of the wall, which was essentially the end of the Soviet Empire, one of the figures in that city, a political police figure who had been prepared for what he called a Tiananmen Square solution, said, "We were prepared for everything.
For violence.
Except prayers and candles." They had no answer to prayers and candles. And after those events, when the wall fell and Germany was reunified, people in that city put a great banner across the main street, and it simply said, "Thank you, church."
We have another caller. Let's go for a quick question. Yes, go right ahead. You're on the air. Line number one.
Okay, I heard your description of the church that you've been involved with in Bloomington, and I wondered if there was anything similar to that in Champaign-Urbana.
Thank you for the question.
We'll turn to the expert on Champaign-Urbana, which is Steve.
Well, there are a number of churches that represent progressive Christianity. They may not be quite as ecumenical as the New Covenant Community Church in Bloomington, but some that come to mind quickly would be, of course, the Unitarian Universalist Church in Urbana, the United Church of Christ, Community United Church of Christ on campus, McKinley Presbyterian Church, others that you would think of. Dick, any that you come to mind?
I think you know this community a whole lot better than I do.
Yes, but I'm
It's been 50 years, Steve.
But you've lived close. Well, those will be some that come to mind that would certainly be accepting of these kind of issues and concerns. Dick, we have just a minute or two left. Any last words?
Well, I'd like to. I think I'd very much like to share with your audience a brief poem that has meant a great deal to me and that I use in the book by Bonaro Overstreet, because the problems of the world seem so overwhelming to us, and we often wonder, what can I as one person do? And it goes like this: "You say the little efforts that I make will do no good. They never will prevail to tip the hovering scale where justice hangs in balance. I don't believe I ever thought they would, but I am prejudiced beyond debate in favor of my right to choose which side shall feel the stubborn ounces of my weight." And that is very important to me, because all we have, each of us, is a few stubborn ounces, but if we put them together with each other, we can begin to tip the scales in the direction of love and of justice.
Well, those are good words to end our program on today. Thank you, Richard G. Watts, Dick Watts, for your book, Hungers of the Heart, Spirituality and Religion for the 21st Century, and for being with us today here on WILL. Next week on Keeping the Faith, we'll be talking with a practitioner of Christian Science, Elise Moore. On January 16, we'll be replaying a archive program from last fall with Carolyn Wright, C.D. Wright, the poet, author of One with Others, that was put up for the National Book Award this year. On January 23rd, Abby Harmon will be our guest, a graduate student here at the University of Illinois in Champaign-Urbana, working with the homeless. She was quite noteworthy because of coming up with the idea of Tent City to really publicize the plight of homeless people in this relatively affluent university town. That'll be on January 23rd with Abby Harmon. I'm Steve Shoemaker, and I want to thank our callers today. We had one that we didn't get put on the air because she chose not to, but she had good words to say about this particular topic and guest today. So thank you for those calls. Thank you for listening to Keeping the Faith.
You've been listening to Keepin' the Faith, the production of WILL AM 580. The opinions expressed on this program are solely those of the participants.
Hi, I'm Jim Fleming, host of To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI. Looking for something to talk about at your next party or around the water cooler on Monday morning? Check in on To the Best of Our Knowledge each week. Science and Religion, Rethinking Animal Intelligence, Maybe How Memory Works. Fascinating discussion on To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International.
Sunday evening from 7 to 9 on AM 580. This is Illinois Public Media, WILL 580 AM and 90.9 FM HD3, Urbana.